So hi, Alton Brown here. It's the Alton Browncast. We're going to be doing the podcast for the next few weeks on the road because we're touring. We're touring the Alton Brown Live Show, the Edible Inevitable Tour. So, and in fact, this is opening night. We're in Rancho Mirage, California, 33 degrees, 44 minutes north and 116 degrees, 24 minutes west, just in case you want to, you know, really keep up with where we are. But we're going to be opening tonight at the McCallum Theater in Palm Desert. The shows that we're going to be doing from the road are going to be a little different from what you guys might be used to. We're not editing this because we're busy and a little bit lazy at the same time. So we're just going to be recording interviews that are all going to be with people involved in the road show and the tour. And then we're just going to put it up there and you'll listen to it and everybody will be happy. So our first guest is somebody that you may not know unless you're in the theatrical world.
Mm-hmm.
And his name is Jim Alon. And Jim, what do you have business cards?
Yes.
What do they say?
Theater director, producer, writer.
So Jim is the director of our live show, and he came in. I didn't think I needed one, by the way, because I fancy myself as clever and knowing how to do all kinds of things. And hey, after all, I had a theater degree, right? I don't know doo-doo, actually. And so I was very lucky that the Jim, we ended up meeting each other because of the Mythbusters.
That's right. Who I worked with last year on the Mythbusters live tour when we shared the same producer as well.
Exactly. Lee Marshall and all of the folks at Magic Space. How did you get tied up with Adam and Jamie?
Through Lee.
How did they pick you?
I was the only one that was pitched to the job because they really wanted somebody who was going to collaborate because they create things like yourselves. And most creators don't realize that they need people until they realize, oh, I'm in over my head in an area I'm not used to.
Right.
So what they did is they brought me down to meet them and talk about ideas. And I started talking to them about how I envisioned we could create a science show that had some spectacle, but allowed them to be still them and have a really good interactive experience with an audience. So I just started talking to them about what the contract with a live audience could be. That would be more sophisticated.
Now, what does that mean, contract with a live audience?
Well, to me...
Explain that.
To me, what we're doing is a kind of a variety show. I think we perform music. We allow moments for them to interact with you. So when the audience comes in, we take them through a series of things. We hold them by the hand. We point their focus in different directions. And we keep looking to surprise them. Because I think over the course of a 90-minute or two-hour experience, you want to surprise people and give them the... gifts they didn't know they wanted. And so to me, that is pulling out all my theatrical background where I'm thinking about how we can make left turns, what the arc of the experience is. And I'm, in a sense, the first audience member. So I want to make the Christmas present I want to get. Working with someone who I like or admire, like the Mythbusters or yourself, and have something to share, something important to share, and you want to have that message delivered clearly and in a package that's pleasing and exciting.
Do you feel like you do your best work when you're already a fan of whoever you're working with?
Well, I think a certain degree of objectivity is better. I haven't worked with anybody except Bono who I just couldn't stand to... I'm stuttering talking about it. I was brought in very briefly as a...
I assume you're not talking about Sonny Bono, but
no,
you're talking about
the former
Bono,
mayor
Bono,
of Palm Springs, which I'm so excited about. I was briefly brought in as a show doctor to help rewrite the concept and the story for Spider-Man on Broadway. And that was in the period where Julie Taymor was being replaced. And they had to have somebody fresh come in and to reimagine how this thing could work, and also just objectively say to them, this should go, this should go, this should go. And it's very hard to tell people who've spent tens of millions of dollars that some of this stuff is just junkyard.
Needs to go.
Junkyard.
But when you get so deep into a project, it's very easy to lose that objectivity and have absolutely no idea where you are anymore.
Exactly. So I saw myself as a sort of triage doctor. It's like I come in, I assess the patient.
We're going to cut off this leg. This has got gangrene. We can't save it. It's gone.
And no matter how much we like that leg and with our ability to walk, it's got to go. We're gonna learn to walk a different way. And so
did you have to look at Bono and tell him something he didn't want to hear?
It was interesting. I was mostly working with Glenn Berger, the writer, the original writer. He had written it with Julie. And we spent our time sort of in his apartment in the village. And I would pace back and forth and sort of pitch things to him. And then he would say things. And we would then get on the phone with Bono. So we would conference call with those guys. And
where was Bono at the time?
He wasn't in New York. That was one of the big problems that had happened early on, that they'd workshopped the show and then they went on a South American tour. And then when they came back, what they saw in previews was a shock to them. And so, you know, the train had gone a long way in a direction that wasn't really connecting with an audience and wasn't connecting with the guys who wrote the music. And so the funny thing for me was on a conference call telling him to re-lyric things. I would just say, well, we have to repurpose that, because we have to tell the story here, and that's the story. We're going to contract 10 minutes of that into hopefully 2 minutes, and we're going to get to this thing. And so then he pulled out an idea for a song he'd had from 6 years ago, and he said, well, can that kick off the second act? So I was essentially saying, we're lopping off what had been the previous beginning of act two, going in a different direction. And then he was fine. You know, people like yourself and people like Edge and Bono are good at what they do. They need to have people who will speak truth to them.
Yeah, because not many do.
Exactly. Everybody will just tell you everything you touch is gold.
You know you're becoming dangerously famous when everybody tells you everything is good. And that's the time to worry. And that's when you've got to start hiring people who won't give you any BS.
And so back to your question, which is just, it's nice that I have enough distance. I did a show with Larry King, and I've seen Larry King. I knew who Larry King was. I've spent a lot of time in hotel rooms overseas, so I've comforted myself with CNN. But I didn't consider myself a fan, and I sort of got into that job going, here's an American icon who wants to do a public show, but what is it about his stories that he's used to telling, you know, whether he's doing a presentation at a conference or a convention or accepting an award? You know, he has tons of amazing experiences and stories, but how can I weave it together into something that's different and actually has an arc? And what I did is told the story. Once I got to know him a little bit, I realized I wanted to tell the story about somebody who's actually a little bit humble, although he doesn't seem it. And his secret is that he thinks he's a normal person speaking to other normal people who do extraordinary things. And so I started spinning that out, and his sort of rags to riches story and the luck and good fortune that's happened in his life. And it became a kind of portrait of a kind of America. You know, so pulling together his love of baseball with the civil rights movement, meeting Jackie Robinson, seeing Jackie Robinson as a kid, I just threw together three of his stories. So it became an arc about family, race relations. And he'd never told a story, which is... he introduced Martin Luther King in Miami in the 60s. And he introduced me, I'd say, he brought him up and he said, I'd like to introduce the founder of the American Civil Rights Movement. And then he walked up and he said, no, that was Jackie Robinson. And so baseball, America, civil rights, Jackie Robinson, and stories that had never been told. And it was like, oh, that's theater. That's a show. And I guess my instincts are to try and find out a kernel of truth about what somebody's going to try to do. Mm-hmm. And then be true to that. Follow the best idea. Follow the instinct. Like, I think early on in our conversations, I kept saying, well, what are we trying to say here? Or, you know, just a few questions to get a sense of what the underlying thing is we're trying to get at.
When you look at your career, say, over the last 10 years, you obviously do a lot of projects from the ground up, from seed, from concept, all the way through. But what percentage of jobs are you saving something? What percentage of jobs are you you're being brought in the middle and kind of being the triage doctor?
Well, I would say I do one or two of those a year, and those are, for me, they're kind of exciting because I have a nature that I love solving problems, and I think that's why early on, once this kind of thing started coming my way, I remember getting a call about a show called Jump that was going to go to off Broadway, and it was a sort of a Jackie Chan martial arts style comedy. And I love slapstick. I love Looney Tunes. I love Jackie Chan. I just thought, wow, that's exciting. But literally, I got on a plane, flew to Korea, got off the plane, went right to the theater to watch a performance with a Korean audience of this show, which I'd seen the show on video, but it was such an out-of-body experience. But I could see immediately what's missing, or where the edits need to occur. And it was just an opportunity. And I always just try to approach those things with a sort of open heart and a willingness to pitch in. And then I think you would have noticed that I'm really pretty calm. And so I'm good at walking into other people's crises and being the calm voice, and also trying to figure out who to speak to in what ways to take, not all the steps, but to take the immediate steps that need to get us a few feet further on, and then look from that perspective. Now, what do we have? And how's the patient doing? And it's kind of great. It's to me, it's a really enjoyable job because everybody's also very grateful.
Because they know that they need something.
Yeah, they've come to they've hit some kind of rock bottom. Nobody makes a decision to
hire
a change.
You. Yeah,
make a change and bring in somebody entirely new. Other than there is a crisis. Another show I enjoyed working on was something off Broadway called Lucky Guy, mm-hmm. and it was a country and western musical. And I'm not particularly a country and western Broadway musical director, but what I was able to do was come in and identify what was wrong with the story. And
because story is story,
and it's really clear when you lose interest. I have to trust my instincts that if I don't understand something, or you have to spend a long time explaining what that's supposed to mean, that I'm going to probably say, "Well, could we clarify that?" Let's go out on a limb here, and also other people. It's funny when people are fixated on an idea. And it actually blinds them to all the other opportunities a situation presents. So you have, for instance, in that instance, there was a lot of quite funny actors who could sing and dance and do lots of things. But they had become kind of trapped in a staging that they were becoming less and less funny. And it's like, wow, we're like sapping their power. And also there were just rudimentary things like the set pieces weren't close enough together. So every time anybody was interacting with anybody, they had to take a hike. So I actually shoved the whole set closer together. People were able to interact more naturally, appear suddenly rather than take a hike to enter a scene. And so the scenery worked better. I could communicate. And as soon as you get creative people engaged in the process again, not fixating on the problems or feeling trapped, everybody gets engaged and the whole thing starts moving again. So sometimes
you got to remove the wall that everybody's butting their head up against.
Yeah, well, and or just say, "Look up, everyone, look up." Like we're fine. We're going to be fine. We're going to make some changes, and let's enjoy that. Let's get back into the process. We were excited by it at some stage earlier, and when we all had some belief, and so it usually also is a huge kickstart of energy.
Sure.
Because actors, when you know they bring me in and introduce me, everybody has eyes go really wide because usually they're only told a change is happening so shortly before it happens.
Right.
And so it's a big jolt.
Which is probably
of energy.
Good because nobody wants to think about that. Nobody wants to think about what that change is going to be.
Right.
Because everybody starts thinking that change is going to be firing me.
Yeah, absolutely. And actors and performers are an insecure breed. So if they're not feeling the love, a lot of that terror either goes outwards and they start hating something or someone, or they turn it in on themselves, and it's usually the second.
Yeah, I can speak to that one. yeah, sure. When one becomes uncertain, yeah, you turn that inward because what else can you do? My fear is always that I'm going to fall in love with something that I did or some idea to the point that I no longer see that something I'm doing sucks. So I always say it's me first. The problem's me. I'm the weak link. And 90% of the time I'm right. And the rest of the time, there's no real problem in at least looking at it that way. It changes your perspective sometimes.
Well, certainly I know your experience with working on things. How many times do you actually enjoy the failing aspect? Like it's sometimes it's kind of exhilarating to do something bold, watch it fail miserably, and you go, okay, I got that out of my system. Like, yeah. I know where that's going. Or Jamie and Adam have a great phrase, which is that they're a slave to the best idea. And so they always are willing to resolve any like strong conflicts they have in an approach to a problem with, let's empirically get to this. And so there's no hard feelings. If we're all serving the same goal and we're all doing it well, it's there's no shame in being wrong. There's absolutely no reason to think, okay, I was behind my version 100%, but as soon as we get to a certain point, let's dump that, hooray, we're moving on.
You've got to be willing to dump anything and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, when you realize at that moment that it's not the right thing to do.
I realized when I was working directing comedy or writing comedy with people that the proudest moments are when you actually give up a really good joke. You've got to, that's when you're with pros. Like, I work with a group called the Kids in the Hall, and the those guys, it's like a master class on how to rewrite. So somebody will write a sketch, and then it, over the process of rehearsal, it gets swarmed like people in a NASCAR pit. You know, people come in, they go, you know, we need different tires on this thing. Or, hold up, can we harvest that joke, that sketch we cut? So then I'll say, glass of wine? Well, I was drinking red in the car. And, you know, it's just harvest a random joke out of another sketch that didn't make it. And it's so interesting to see minds like that work. And then they're willing to cut jokes that are on their own are hysterical. Like, you just realize, okay, but if we hit that beat there, that pushes us off in this direction, and we're not getting to the nut of it at all.
Right.
So it's that kind of willingness to give up things, to not be precious.
Not be precious. It's an interesting concept. Not be precious. Well, if you're cutting something that is funny but doesn't work at the time, then it always goes back into the spare parts store for later, and it will ultimately serve some use.
Yeah. Dave Foley has a photographic memory. It's something that actually unnerves me. Like, we can be talking about something, and they'll say, what about that sketch we did on the TV? No, we didn't do it at the TV show. We did it at the Rivoli. And it was a ghost walks in, and then he'll recite the sketch. And this will be something from 20-something years ago.
And you're like, okay, dude, that's creepy.
It's creepy. It's like, what unnatural gods are you worshipping in your spare time, Dave?
What are you drinking or eating that allows you for that kind of thing? You've worked with them quite a bit, Kids in the Hall.
Mm-hmm.
How many shows have you done with them?
We've done three tours and then a couple of one-offs along the way. But starting in 2000, I've known the guys since like the 80s. Because we're all Canadian. It's a very small Hutterite village
small community up there in that country. It's not a big country.
A lot of land, not a lot of people compared to America. So it was really great. Like they were actually instrumental in my starting to work in America because they had a television show,
mm-hmm.
and then
sure.
because we all knew each other, when they made that, I was doing theater in Toronto and creating shows with wonderful people and having a great time of it. But then they wanted to find a way to do sketch in a larger format. They were able to in 2000 when they got back together after a long hiatus. They were going to be playing 1,500 seats, 2,000 seats, and they'd only ever really done comedy on television and comedy in clubs or big clubs. So that started in 2000. It worked really well, and that was introduced me to a whole bunch of producers who then started inviting me down to do other things in the States, and one thing led to another. I met Lee Marshall with a weird show I did off-Broadway called The Marijuana Logs. And that was a show that had been sort of a success in comedy clubs. And then we reformatted it like the Vagina Monologues. And I imagined that it was a State of the Dope Nation thing. And I redivided all the great comedy writing that had been done by Doug Benson, Arj Barker, and Tony... Oh, what's Tony's last name? Oh, never mind. They'd done great comedy writing, but I redistributed the material. So there was the leader, the super stoner, and the scientist. And so suddenly the material had something like characters. Mm-hmm. And then it was tailored, and Lee must have thought it was funny. The show was interesting. It was fun. Didn't really make money, but ran fairly long off Broadway. And eventually, Tommy Chong came in. So Tommy and I got to write dope jokes.
Wrote dope jokes with half a Cheech and Chong.
Yes.
That's like going to the Oracle of Delphi. I mean,
yeah.
How do you beat that?
Yeah, exactly. It was what was so sweet about it. It's also, you know, he's an older man in his 60s, and he'd already gone through the experience of having to go to jail, which is a long and horrid story of entrapment. But he was such a gentleman, and he just simply said to me, like so many people you meet that are really famous, he was just really wanting to make a simple connection. He goes, do you want Tommy Chong the actor, or do you want the Chong character from that? Like, where are we starting here? And he and I sat down, and it was really simple to work with him and just put him into our show, rewrite some things with him so that they fit his voice better. Mm-hmm. And he was great. And he was, in fact, he was, like a lot of these people, he's easier to work with than some, you know, temperamental 20-something actor who thinks he knows how to act. So it was great. It was sweet. And anyways, that was how we met Lee Marshall. And I had no idea that a few years later, out of the blue, he would call me up and say, I want you to come down and meet these Facebook Mythbusters guys. It was because he was following me on Facebook. That's why he said he called me. He never posted anything except occasionally pictures of Park City, Utah, and the mooses and the golf courses he goes to. But then there he was.
And then you came down, and there were Jamie and Adam, and they wanted all of a sudden take Mythbusters on the road, which one would think is a very difficult thing to do.
Well, for me, it seems straightforward in that it's like almost like a circus show. Mm-hmm. You know,
which it is.
You bring out the elephants.
Right.
Okay, the elephants come in, the clowns come in, then we bring the cute kids out of the audience. I don't know which one of those two is the pretty girls. I guess we'll talk about that later.
I don't think it's Jamie.
No. No, Jamie is the strong man, obviously. He's like the robot. He's the Terminator.
Terminator.
And the great thing about working with those guys too is they know who they are, and they're Jamie in particular was really committed to saying, "Well, I don't want us to be presenting like we think we're all that. We just have interesting jobs." I was going, "Yes, Jamie.
Yes, Jamie.
Yes, sir."
It's important though to know who you are. If you're building shows on known personalities, known characters, then that's already a promise to the audience. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like in building this show that we're embarking on this evening. You know, it's been a constant balance, at least for me, of what do I want to do against what do my fans and what do my audience expect, and what will they let me do that they haven't had me do before. So it's like deciding to add music to the show was like because we haven't actually done it yet, balancing, okay, I want to do this. I think it's within the boundaries of the character. I think the audience will let me go there, but I'm not 100% sure.
Well, what's nice about it is that over the week, the growth I've seen in rehearsal is you're becoming more and more you doing them. Because as soon as we're revealing you, and they're getting to see a aspect of you, but it's still got your trademark humor. You know, so obviously it gets down to practical considerations, which is balance.
Balance.
Like, are the songs too long? Do we get
yes.
the point? Well, that's what we discovered.
Yes.
That's what we discovered last night, which is simply that we want to get to the point quicker, which is get right. everything we can out of them. And so it's not, again, it's not personal. It's not, we shouldn't be precious with it.
Right.
We're just like, okay, that's a great song. It's 3 minutes, 2 minutes and 20 would be better.
Yeah.
Or 2:35.
It's not a Fabergé egg. It's
yeah.
actually a song and
yeah.
it's serving a greater purpose.
And what's the arc? Is there
yeah.
an arc to it? And when are we finished? When are we done? That's a good thing for a performer to know. Are we done?
Are we done?
We've finished. There we go. Or when I talk to you about like turning the chapters, like you conclude a section, exhale and move into the next one, because you don't want a show to always feel like you're just rushing from thing to thing. You have to let the experience, what you've just had or done, color you, finish, and now we begin something new. And an audience likes that rhythm, and they follow you again, and it gives more opportunities for them to see you experiencing what you're doing for them, and it just tells the story better. But again, it's very easy to think that if we hurry up and get on with things, that would be better, and it isn't. So it's a balancing act. And sometimes, like when you're coaching actors or working with actors or performers of any kind, it's a lot like coaching an athlete. It's you know, somebody can run really fast. You're not going to re-explain what it is to go fast. You're going to say, "How are your feet? I feels like your feet aren't in the right position. It feels like you're too far back on your heels," or you start breaking it down for them.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can break it down for you, then you experience what you're doing a little differently, and then you put that aside and go back to doing what you do. That helps open up the process we're going through, or how you do what you do. And
that's
again,
a good way of looking at it.
Yeah, it's
I think some of the best advice you've given me is stop. you know, slow down, let this breathe here, let this end, you know, because it is my, certainly from television, you know, timing, I understand the timing of the editing room. I understand the time of the cut, trying to make that have its own kind of analog on stage, though, is a trickier thing, especially when you're constantly trying to gauge what the audience wants, what's the audience doing, what they're feeling. I've done this enough to know that every house is different, every audience is different, and you've got to figure out pretty early on what's the personality of that particular audience and how that's going to affect what you're doing that evening. But I tend to follow them too much instead of lead them, if you know what I mean.
I do, and I think you also have to give yourself permission to hear that and feel that and not think, you can't be trying to please them all the time either. You have to be able to go, they didn't get that. Oh, well, moving on. And so you want to just be, again, put yourself in kind of open, not a defensive place, put yourself in a position to, and now I'm going to do something I really like. And push them in that direction. Come with me. You've trusted me so far. Let's go.
Come on. We're going to go over here now.
Yeah. And that's using the word variety for this show is kind of like it also allows us to show sides of you, the way you interact with different. It's almost your own gallery. You're going around and showing parts of yourself, and it's by you encountering the ideas you've set up in the order you've set them up, the audience gets to experience Alton in a way they didn't see on television, because that's an edited experience. This is you real time doing things you want to do or present, and us watching you go through the experience of that is a pleasure they didn't know they were going to get. Because they don't think about it. They think they're going to get more of what they already know.
It's just going to be the TV experience, only the TV shaped differently.
Yeah, exactly. A bigger TV, and I guess they'll have more big screens. And so when they get there, that's why it's kind of fun and disarming the way we open the show, because it's very unexpected. And I think
we're going to hit you with a song.
Yeah, we're going to do that. And also the tone of it. And that one of the first things you do is mention a question your daughter asked you. Great. You know, again, you want to acknowledge what they're here for, and then say, and we're doing that, and we're doing other things.
And we're doing other things.
Yeah. Things you might not have thought.
Do you find that when you did the Mythbusters show, you've got two personalities to deal with that allows for a very, very different kind of show structure. Is that ultimately an easier quiver to work from when you've got just, you know, okay, and then, like with me, you got one. With Mythbusters, you got two that already have this great dynamic with each other.
They're a great comedy
contrast.
Team.
Yeah. So you've got a straight guy, and you know, it's Abbott and Costello,
yeah,
in a way. Is that an easier thing to express on stage, an easier thing to pull off live?
I think it comes down to the quality of the thinking. Like if one of the people was, first of all, they have a system to work together. So sort of trying to understand how that worked, it
right.
was important early on.
And what is that?
Well, that they are business partners. You know, they're not like buddies who go on camping trips. They're great casting for a television show about science, about testing myths. And so as soon as I realized this is not about a show about sharing their friendship and all good buddies, it's rather two really interesting people who have a healthy conflict and a healthy excitement about ideas. And they realize that they're the odd couple and that there is some value in exploring that. And the tension they have and the way they are so different. Exploring that sort of tension allows us to write material where they both solo, they both come together. One's the talker, one's the more silent one. And they, so once we locked into what that culture was, once I understood what the dynamic was, then I was able to pitch things, ideas to them, and speak to both of them in a way that meant something to them. And we could have a meaningful discussion. So like we were inventing all these giant sequences mostly by remote. Like we would get on calls and I would say, I think it's the story of this little section is like this, and they would talk about how we were going to build the device, and I would, and we would have different ideas about where the sort of entertainment value was, but they've got a lot of experience working with people, and so it was just sort of a push and pull. So it, easier, just unique. I think the key thing is, once you and I figured out we could trust each other and we understood each other, we could discuss the ideas and how what we wanted to present in a kind of shorthand. And the sooner you get to that real discussion, rather than you're trying to, either of us are trying to sell somebody on something, like, okay, I'm pitching you on this, you're going to follow me, right? As soon as you get past that stuff, I think you could find a common ground. You could find a place to work from. And what I've been blessed with the last several years is to be able to work with really good people. So it's very comforting to me to show up and think I'm one of a whole bunch of people who are pretty good at what they do. Not, okay, I'm here, what am I going to do?
Right.
Yeah, how's this going to work? How am I going to dress up this pig?
So hopefully you're at a point now. I mean, when's the last time that you walked onto a project and thought, oh, crap, I can't save this. All I can do is start to dig the hole that we're gonna put the body in. I mean, does that ever happen?
Well,
you don't have to be, you know, give particulars.
I'm not going to name names.
No, you shouldn't.
No, but if it's mostly it's to do with conflict of personality, or if someone has made a serious, like I had to fire somebody a couple of months ago off a project I was developing, and I realized that for whatever was going on in that person's life as a performer, as a person, whatever I'd seen in an audition wasn't coming into the room at all. And so all sorts of other people were being really good and funny, and this person just wasn't clicking at all. And I couldn't save them. So I felt bad that I cast them. And it was just the right thing to do for the project.
You got to know when to...
You got to know when to cut your loss, when the hand's got to go. Yeah, or
you're going to lose the hand, or yeah, you're going
to
die.
Well, and you also have to serve the project. You have to serve the greater idea. And so it wasn't, I tried not to, for it to be personal. And if anybody comes to me with a show doctor job and they say, well, here's this.
Is that an actual title, by the way? Show doctor?
Yeah, it is.
A show doctor.
It is.
I like that. What we need here is a show doctor.
Yeah. Somebody, or you bring in people for punch up. Like that's another thing you
punch
do.
Punch up. What does that mean?
Punch
just
up.
Just to kind of
jokes.
You need jokes.
Somebody come in
and punch this thing up
and literally
bit.
Say, okay, this is a good scene, but we need more jokes. You punch it up. Another job I've done is polishing. You take a script and you polish it. You just take away all the extra stuff that's just an extra thumb. Why do we need an extra thumb in that scene? You know, and you just start taking things away. So I've turned down show doctor jobs when I literally look at something and I go, I don't even know where to begin. Whatever people loved about this, I don't see it. I don't love it. I don't know where to begin. I don't know what this is supposed to be. This is roadkill.
There must have been a point where Spider-Man felt that way.
Well, I was in a position where I had a short burst of adrenaline to the project, and I work with Glenn. I helped Glenn sort of recover his energy and mojo a bit.
Yeah, because there was still a lot of bad blood at that point. I mean,
things were really hard.
Issues were really hard.
All of that. So all I was able to do is break story. I just said with him, this is the story. Why should we care about Uncle Ben dying? We don't have any scenes that Uncle Ben means anything. So how about he have a scene where he sort of stands up in a simple heroic way earlier, then we'll have a little funeral. Then we'll have, you know, so we'll give him some weight in the story. So the ghost father Peter Parker has to live up to for the rest of this musical meant something. Because there was nothing like that. There was too busy getting to giant effects or grand images, and it was like Glenn Berger is a very smart guy and a good writer, so as soon as he had the opportunity again to let's break the story, it was exciting for him, and I think it helped, and it helped clarify things for Edge and Bono, and then they went on. So I didn't stay on to like write the new draft that's on stage now. I just broke the story with them and reimagined it, and
in other words, it was stuck in the mud, and you came along with something that you could shove under a tire, and you got it out of the
right.
ditch.
And I just pointed out all the things that really weren't serving the thing they wanted to do, which I assumed was a good Spider-Man show for all ages.
One would think,
but it stopped being that at a certain point. It had become a sort of a grand opera about the myth of something. And again, all those things I could say in a kind of calm way were sacred cows. There were like these... You know, It's not, we're serving the myth of Spider-Man that everybody's experienced for 50 years and all its aspects. And I'm going, I don't even know what any of that means. Shouldn't we just care about whether Uncle Ben had an effect, his death had an effect on the audience and on the character? Shouldn't we go with that?
Yeah.
And, but at a certain point, things become, you know, Emperor's New Clothes. You know, you walk in and you have to actually be the one who says,
you're naked.
I'm sorry.
You're not.
You're very
anything.
Attractive.
But you don't have any clothes on.
Yeah, you don't have any clothes on, and this isn't serving the show. This isn't. And you, at a certain point, hope that. And the great thing, liberating thing about those things is you just get to say it, and then you either they keep you or they don't. But it's not your.
But it's your actual job to do it.
Yeah, and you also want to be honest. You hope that they chose you because you got on the phone. And so back to your question, which is, yeah. So I turn down things that I go, I can't support this. I can't. Take your money.
I got nothing.
Yeah. I got nothing. I don't get it. I don't know what you're on about. And even in especially sometimes when producers try to describe what a show is going to be, because they talk to me before they introduce me to the creatives, because the creatives are always really nervous. The creatives know that things are out of control and the money is burning and they're losing the faith of the cast. Everything. A live show is either growing or it's dying. And if it's very evident when the show is in its death throes. And if you...
Would you mind telling me how to spot that so I'll know when it happens
when
to me?
I'll be trying to say,
whoa, wait a minute, I'm dying.
Yeah. Well, mostly it stops feeling like... It starts feeling by rote, and also there's a vague underlying sense of disappointment. Like what Glenn Berger said to me that really touched me, he knew it in previews, like long before they were able to make any significant changes, and long before I was involved. He saw... The kids weren't happy. He went out in intermission, and the kids weren't happy. They'd come with their parents. They spent a lot of money to go see Spider-Man, and he just remembered a particular 8-year-old, and I can't remember what the 8-year-old said to his mother, but Glenn was there, and it just broke Glenn's heart. And so at that point, he started thinking, well, whatever we got to do, it's got to be major. And then shortly after that, Bono and Edge came back, and they were really disappointed with what it had become. And then eventually, because of course, you know, Julie's got an amazing track record. You know, the producers and everyone kept behind her and trying to let her win the day. But at a certain point, it just becomes intractable. There's injuries. People are lost. They're lost in the woods.
Lost in the woods. And sometimes you have to know when to call off the search party. You certainly can't lead if you're lost.
Yeah.
I mean, for a while you can, maybe. Yeah. You can get away with that. But
well,
if you're
and your best
lost,
past practice, like what when you have a... I've watched you think and work through problems this week, and what I like is the analytical approach you have, because you bring all of your previous experience to solving a problem, and then, like, where does your mind go first when you're looking at a problem? Like, what I observed is that you bring a laser focus to the issue, and you start dissecting the component parts. And to you, that feels really natural, but most people can't do that.
Well, I think because for my own part, I've spent most of my career directing either television commercials or television shows and editing them and writing them. So to me, it's always, I'm always looking at sequence. I'm always looking at story. It's like, it's interesting that, you know, if I've made a show for years and years that was primarily about food science. And I've spoken to a lot of science groups who everyone in the room had a better brain box than me and knew a lot more about science than me. And my whole thing was, the reason I'm good at what I'm doing is I don't let all that stuff actually get in the way. I won't let facts get in the way of concept. You know, you can look at me and say, well, actually, the blah, 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 the blah. I'm like, look. All I care about is getting people to understand what concepts are. Grasp a concept. If the facts don't work for me, I don't use them, you know, because I'd rather people have an aha moment that leads them someplace mm-hmm. than to be exact. And I think that I approach all structural issues that way, you know, which is, you know, all structures are the same. Story's the same. There's story. And you know, you talk a lot about arcs, and I'm a huge believer in an arc, and that there has to be connective tissue, that this makes sense to this, and this comes over here. And so at any given point in a problem-solving thing, it's usually start taking things off until the machine doesn't work anymore. And then guess what? Whatever is left off and it's still working, well, guess what? You didn't need that. You know, it's like, hey, you know, taking the frosting off until you find the cake.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you find out you don't need any frosting, I guess.
Right. Or raisins.
You sure as hell don't need raisins. Raisins are optional. Raisins are like barbecue sauce. They're usually there to cover something.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't trust raisins at all.
Well, and often people, I find get themselves into trouble when they're creating things because they're obsessed with one or two things. Like, they're just obsessed, and to the detriment of the whole project. They just can't step back and look at the structure because this view of a character is so important to them. Or they, I don't know, they just it's like blinders. And if you can't step back and take in the wider experience of it, how are you going to find that transformation moment, find that aha moment, find that liftoff? You know, there's lots of different ways we could describe how we work on our things. Or it's like a riff, you know, like you can build a song out from a riff. You could build a song out from lyrics. You can do approach any creative act or scientific act, but using your strengths or your predilection. You know, if your predilection is outside in or inside out, but if you're not willing to let go of that and observe it from a different point of view, which could be your collaborator's point of view, or just to allow for the opportunity for another idea to happen, like because you look at it upside down, then it's in that. That's where the real creative jumps happen, and you've got to.
That's where the quantum leaps are born.
Yeah, exactly. And when I started thinking about what quantum leaps were, whatever point in my life that was, where I just started thinking, that's true. That's what the ahas are. That's what the transformations are in it, when you're reading a novel, when you suddenly are transformed, or the character. You know, it's this. That's the exciting stuff of life, and you want to in your work practice. Build in a way to do that or have that, because if you're so narrowly focused when you approach a problem or a creative process, you're never going to find that stuff. It's just too limiting. You set up yourself to fail or have very limited, repetitive, mechanical kind of solutions to things. So I'm really grateful, for instance, to have had so many different experiences working with so many different kinds of creative people. Like, working on comedy is so different than working on a dramatic show or things like that. And I try to be let the breadth of my experience keep me open and responsive to what I'm doing, and ask myself honestly, well, is this really... am I really bringing all of that to this project? And can I open my... Can I not get... too narrowly focused to not be honestly responding to it, I guess.
Got it. Very cool. You've got to be able to keep, a big part of your job is just simply being able to keep your head open, you know, and get your head up, get your view high enough up to see all the landscape of all these different projects.
And also just be, find a way to bring out the good part of each of the people playing the game with you, mm-hmm. you know, so that, you know, you, which is sometimes why you want to, like, I always, the first thing I do when I get in the building is go around and check in with everybody. Mm-hmm. I just really want to find, how's your day? What are you thinking? What was troubling you about that yesterday? Remember when I said that thing yesterday? What do you think about that? Maybe I'm not, or I'll go around and ask, or I almost ask everyone's artistic opinion at some point in the show, and I soon find out who the people are I want to make repeat visits to. But I certainly want to get them engaged in what we're doing, and you'll get amazing solutions sometimes from the most unlikely sources, because again, they've got such a unique experience and point of view that, yep. that they're able to just like cut through the you're in the woods you're mucking around going, I don't know how I'll ever solve that problem, and then someone will say to you, you know, couldn't that just move over there,
like, and you go like,
oh my god yeah. I'm such an idiot.
Yeah.
The willingness to accept, I have so many blind spots, you know, we all have so many
sure.
blind spots, and sometimes they're temporary, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, I'm coming off of not a lot of sleep because my kids are young, and then so I come into the room and I'm kind of don't have a bounce in my step, so that day, that moment, I'm not able to see the lighter thing something needs, but then the very next day I'm fine, and oh, it's obvious,
it's clear as a bell.
Yeah. And so that's also trusting in the idea of a process,
Ah.
You know, if you've got, you've got to imagine that this exists over time. And actually, that's something that, that I'm pretty good at with stage. I'm interested in what happens over the time we are together, from the time they walk into the building, from the time they sit down, how different things are happening to them. For instance, like doing shows in the winter and like people having enough time to warm up, but then you've got to keep the theater a little bit cold so they don't get sleepy. You know, there's all these sort of like things you learn along the way.
Experiential little things, corrections to dial into the process.
Yeah, and you can't do theater in steely cold light. No matter, comedy dies. If you put a steely cold light on something, no matter how funny the material is, it'll get ha 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 ha. It'll get vague smiles because it drains the life out of the skin tone.
Comedy needs warmth.
It needs warmth. It needs color in the skin tone. It needs expression. You can't have lights at such a high angle that you get kind of a raccoon eye effect, mm-hmm. because people have got to see the sparkle in a person's eyes when they tell something. It's all these kind of things you accumulate and you bring to a process that you just think, okay, I won't spot all the problems or all the mistakes every day, but I'll be knocking things off that list as soon as I become aware of them. Hopefully I'll have a solution, or I can turn to one of the other collaborators and go...
And recognize the solution.
Yeah, and go, I don't know what's going on, but something's going on there. And could you tell me... can you see
anybody it? Got it? Anybody?
Yeah.
Something. It's something.
Exactly. So again, that process orientation also means that I don't feel responsible for everything every day. I show up, I'm going to do my work. I'm going to probably work as hard or harder than anybody else. Which is why I love someone like you. Cause I go, boy, that guy knows how to work.
If nothing else.
Exactly. Well, you see, that's the humility. Like the, podcast listeners, Alt got a little embarrassed when I said that because he knows that about himself, but it's the least he would demand of himself. You know, it's the way you live, right? It's the code you have, which is, I think, Jamie and Adam have that. I work hard. It's this sense that you shouldn't do any less than your best, and that then you can at least, at the end of the day, if it all went wrong, you can get up to fight the fight again.
Right.
And so it again goes back to it not being precious.
Got it.
You know, you
above all, be not precious.
Yeah, exactly.
Thou shalt not be precious.
Yeah, because then you really, that's back to that whole thing of obsessing on something. Oh, it's so pretty. It's so pretty. It's so pretty. That's the thing I have to do. No, it's one of a bunch of choices. And as soon as you limit yourself, well, you're going to eliminate all those other opportunities to have a good creative idea and fun. And so the great thing about once we, I think, recognize that in each other early on, is it's like, well, we'll get them tomorrow. You know, there's things on the list we got to do. We'll get it tomorrow.
Yeah. It's fine.
Yeah.
We have the tools.
Yeah, we have the tools. We have the people.
Yeah.
Like, I get scared when I realize I'm in a fight I'm not going to win. When I actually walk into a room and I go, I'm not going to win this battle with these people. Like, nobody else is bringing it the way it needs to be done. And so then you try to make recommendations and changes and things like that. And sometimes it's also when people are just too beat down, you know. They're just like, then you
defeated.
Have to try and spark something.
Yeah.
If you're, once people are defeated, it's very hard to rally the team for a big fourth quarter comeback. You know.
Come on, get up.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll stop bleeding soon.
Exactly. You see the basket, shoot the basket. You know, don't overthink this, stupid.
Well, God, overthinking. That's a sin that I commit, that's for sure.
Absolutely. And also allowing for people to have different tastes. That's another thing. Sometimes people take it as a very personal insult, and that's back to the preciousness thing. It's like, it's not to my taste. My kid's obsessed over the fact that I'm not really into strawberries and blueberries. I'm like, well, I just don't think they're that big a deal. Everybody else is really excited about them. They're like, obsessed about that. If we're trying to open up something fun, then the preciousness of what people fixate on is a problem.
As well, it should be. Well, hopefully we haven't fixated on something on our show so completely that that that's happened?
Well, the great thing is we're in the process, and I think we're all trusting the process. I recognize all the quality of what you're doing and what I think the audience experience is going to be. And so to me, it's like, well, we've got an abundance of riches. So it's picking and choosing. That's this part of the process. And I'll trust that you'll know more in three shows than you do now. And in a week, you and I'll get on the phone and you'll say, I've got this thought. What do you think? And then I'll be a good sounding board for you, and then changes will be made. And
so I can do that?
Oh, yeah. Unless the phone rings and I'll be like, oh, I can't look at this.
I can't. Well, I know if I call three times and don't get you, I'll know exactly what's going on.
I've been moving on. Teller's got my attention at that point.
Well, you know, and well, Teller sometimes emails me about biscuits, but that's about the only time I hear from him. Well, Jim, I very much appreciate you working on the show. You were the guy that I didn't want to need. You were the guy I didn't want to admit that I needed.
Right.
And then once I did, I realized, wow, you were pretty much Santa Claus. So thank you. Thank you for being Santa Claus.
Oh, it's been a lot of fun.
You brought a lot of gifts, and thanks for taking time to talk to us. Good luck tonight. I hope to do you proud.
Oh, I'm really excited. It's going to be great.
We'll see. I got a great bus, though.
I got an
awesome bus.
You got the stealth bus.
I got the stealth bus. Well, thanks very much for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
So that's it. That was a nice long talk with the director of my show, the Edible Inevitable Tour, which used to be the Inevitable Edible. And we keep moving it around. Doesn't matter. Next podcast will be someone else from the road as we take this tour out over the next few weeks. So keep listening. Alton Brown signing off on the Alton Brown Cast. And don't forget, America, cook smart.